with Ask Dr. Gale. Today we're going to talk about deep religious questions, and specifically in terms of how we discuss them in terms of teaching our young people. And our first guest is Mary Kearns, and she's a chaplain at the First Christian Church. So, Mary, thank you for being here.
Sure. It's an honor.
Could you tell us a little bit about how you came to be a chaplain? What was your girlhood religious experience like?
Okay. Well, I was raised in a Catholic home, and I, my mom was instrumental in that. I know through her teaching and through the traditions that we had in our home, and I also know, you know, what I learned at parochial school, that was the foundation of my faith. And so a very normal, regular Christmas and Easter and fish on Friday kind of Catholic upbringing. I would have to say, though, most of my life I've always heard the word of God. It's always been kind of a calling there deep in my heart, and it had played out in different ways. My call to chaplaincy didn't come until later in adulthood, actually. I got away from the Catholic Church due to some of their more rigid teaching and some of their more rigid rules. My mother got divorced, sadly, and the response from the church to her and in albeit to us became less than welcoming in that day and age. And so my journey to find a God that was kinder and more open and inclusive, that's when that began for me. So I, you know, dabbled around with some different faith traditions in my teen years, and then I settled on a faith where I attended the college that taught it, and that was the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, and I attended Northwest Christian University in Eugene, Oregon.
Why did you pick that particular school?
I really loved their motto about no creed but Christ, no law but love, no book but the Bible, in essentials unity, in non-essentials liberty, and in all things love. That really spoke to me. And some of the other sayings from the founding people of our movement were that we aren't the only Christians, we're Christians only. And I thought, yes, I wasn't about to tell everyone, you know, you're going to hell because you're not doing it right. You know, that really didn't speak to me. And so I found the Christian church. And they were also supportive of women in ministry. That was another really big step for me, because some of the denominations I had had visited were not. And I wanted to follow the calling God had put on my heart. So I attended college there, met my husband there. We were married. And a couple years later, we decided to go to seminary back east in Tennessee. And so we attended Emmanuel School of Religion. And while I was there, I pastored little congregations and did youth ministry and, you know, just did a whole range of ministry opportunities back there. My call to chaplaincy came when my third son was born, and he was born with an extremely rare genetic disorder. And as a consequence of that, our life changed. We went from you know, packing up all the kids and going on a trip to the beach to packing up all the kids and all the medical equipment and checking with all the doctors and making sure it was okay that we could do this with our son, and having 9 doctors on speed dial on your phone and arguing with insurance companies over not exploratory treatment, but the use of a really expensive drug, which did help my son, but, you know, there wasn't enough science behind the use of it to justify it. So we had to go round and round and round and all that. But so my call to chaplaincy came quite literally. We were in the halls of Kluge Children's Hospital in Charlottesville, Virginia, and it was genetic clinic day. And we had already gotten our diagnosis. We were just back for the second visit. And so we knew what we were dealing with, and we were kind of okay. You know, there was treatment. We knew we had a plan. Our kid was doing okay. My husband and I were doing okay. And in walked this couple, and the look on their faces, they were just terrified. Mm-hmm. And they're holding their precious little baby, and I just looked at them, and I went, I know what that feels like. I know exactly what that feels like. And that's when the Lord said to me, Mary, this is going to be your new parish. And so I leaned over to my husband and I said, hey, honey, what do you do to start working in a hospital as a pastor? And he says, I think you need to become a chaplain. And so that was in 2005. And I started going to school for it. I did my internship and residency through the Sutter Hospital System down in Sacramento, and I was fully board certified in September of 2016.
So how long does it take to be a chaplain? How many units or semesters, or what kind of educational program is it?
You have to have a Master's of Theology or a Master of Divinity. You have to have standing in some religious body, because chaplains do it all. So we have Buddhist chaplains, Jewish chaplains, Catholic, Hindu, you name it, Muslim. But you have to be ordained, commissioned, licensed, whatever, from your own religious endorsing body. And then you have to have that master's degree. And then you have to do 4 units of clinical pastoral education at a clinical pastoral education teaching hospital. And then you have to do a residency, and then you have to do 2,000 hours of work experience.
Wow.
And then you have to do a competency paper addressing 33 competencies to pass that, and then you defend it, and then you become a chaplain. So it's extremely rigorous.
Yes.
And it took me 11 years, because we moved from Virginia to California, and so I kind of had a 6-7 year hiatus in there, but I got back to it and I finished it in September.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So where is your degree from, for your chaplain?
It's not a degree, it's a license.
Okay.
Through the Association of Professional Chaplains, and so you can look them up online.
Okay.
Yeah.
You mentioned that the Lord told you that this was going to be your calling. Mm-hmm. Does that mean God? Does that mean Jesus? What does Lord mean to you?
I self-identify as what I call a Krista Buddha Hindu. I am Christocentric. I that Catholic upbringing and a Trinitarian God is still very, very influential in my life. But what Buddhism taught me was how to be fully present in the moment, and how to be peaceful in that moment, and how to help people be in great pain and still find peace in that moment. So the teachings of Buddha about non-attachment have been really instrumental in my clinical practice and personal practice. And then I self-identify a little bit with Hinduism, because I just can't sit and pray. I've got to move. And so yoga is a huge foundation for me. And as I'm doing my asanas, it's not uncommon for me to have different scripture going through my mind. And once I get moving, I hear God. I hear that voice, that small, still voice. Or if you want to call it intuition, or if you want to call it the mother spirit, I'm open to that. All I know is, there are times when that voice speaks and I am compelled, I must answer.
And so how do you distinguish between God and Jesus in that voice?
I'm not really sure I do. I don't think I've ever had a moment where I thought, this is Jesus talking to me and this is God talking to me. It's always just kind of been that, what I call the still small voice. Sometimes it wakes me up at 3 a.m. and I get up and journal, and other times it tells me, go and talk to that person, they're down, or listen to the call that was placed in my life in the halls of a hospital and pursue something. It took me 11 years to get it, but that still small voice said, you need to do this and finish it. So I did.
I read a novel one time that said that luck is going with the current, the kind of the path of knowledge that's right for you, and being unlucky is stepping outside that current of guidance. So that stuck with me, because I think if we listen, then we can go with that flow like a current mm-hmm. on a river, and we're guided.
I know there have been times when I ignored that voice, or the voice said, don't do it, and I did anyway, and I really regretted it later, you know. So now I'm learning, and that's the other thing that Buddhism has taught me, is to really take a moment and take time and step back and listen to that voice. That's it's important to take those timeouts and get your peace back.
Some Christians think that there's only one way to salvation, that because we're born inherently sinful because of Adam and Eve's failings, that the only way to be redeemed is through accepting the sacrifice that Jesus made for humans. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that that's true?
I believe that that's true for some people. I don't have that core value. My core value, I don't believe in original sin. I really don't. That is something that I've gotten away from. I think my core value would more illustrate that apart from God, we are nothing. And there is evil in this world. I have seen evil. I have experienced evil. But I think so much more of what I hear my brothers and sisters say from other denominations, they give too much weight and power to the bad choices that people make, and kind of put a demon and a devil behind everything. And I'm kind of like, no, I wouldn't quite put it that strongly. But I know for me that Christ is my Savior, and I know that the sacrifice that was made on the cross is instrumental. But I also have a really hard time condemning babies and children to a sin that they had nothing to do with. I mean, to me, sin is making a choice. And babies can only react on instinct until they, you know, grow up and develop a cognitive ability to make a choice. So I can't subscribe to original sin.
So that means that anybody who is on a spiritual path can find the beautiful afterlife. You don't have to only go through Christ.
I would agree with that. As a chaplain, I have seen so many people pass away from different faith traditions, and I have seen a beautiful death in so many different religious experiences and religious expressions. And so I've learned to be comfortable with the mystery of God more so than the black and white concrete answers of God, because it seems to me every single time we try to put God in a box, she does something amazing. You know, or the creator just zaps us with something else and we're like, oh, it's bigger than we thought. So that's one good thing that chaplaincy did for me, is it got me out of my singular box. I have a foundation, and my foundation is important, but I don't think that I have to take every other religion and cram it into my understanding. I just, whatever I learn, I say, bless you, wonderful. Oh, that's wisdom. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that with me. Thank you for being a blessing.
I want listeners to know that I invited a Jewish rabbi and a Muslim and a Catholic who studied to be a Jesuit priest and then left, but the rabbi was on vacation, and the other two are not here yet, or maybe never will be here today. So I want listeners to know that we were interested in a variety of points of view. But how wonderful that Mary's here. In terms of politics, the Pope Francis, who I think a lot of us admire for really speaking like a Christian in terms of concern for the poor, mm-hmm. and the immigrants, the refugees. He said Donald Trump is not a Christian because he doesn't have that kind of concern or regard for people who are suffering. So what do you think of that?
I really like this Pope. I really, really like this Pope. And not just because he's not afraid to call people on their stuff. And he has power to wield in a positive way. You know, he has papal authority to make very important decisions and statements towards governments and toward world leaders. So I see him using his authority in a wonderful way, in ways that I haven't seen for years. Absolutely. And I'm really happy about that. Really, really happy about that. I abhor getting into political discussions. I really, really do. And I think the thing I would say right now about our presidency is I'm praying and praying that there will be opportunities for growth and learning and listening to both sides.
So what I don't understand is what the an evangelical community that is voted for Trump and thinks he's marvelous, how they reconcile Christian beliefs with Trump's policies and his attitudes towards women and adultery and all those kind of things that don't seem to fit evangelical values.
It does seem like a disconnect, a big disconnect. I have two theories. I really don't know if any other of my brothers and sisters have this kind of feeling or insight, but it just seems to me that the abortion issue is an extremely volatile issue, and an extremely near and dear to their heart. You know, they are protecting the unborn. That is a high, mighty calling for them. And so to support a candidate who 99% of what you didn't like about him, but there was 1% you could, and it was your passionate calling, you know, a defenseless baby. That's what I heard. And compared to Hillary Clinton, who they said supported third term abortion. Right. So that's what I have heard, is people just said, you know, I closed my eyes, I gritted my teeth, and I voted for someone who I would never take my daughter around, but daggone it, you know, we're going to protect the unborn. So that's some rationale right there. And the other rationale is sometimes we just kind of have this disconnect with the people who are in power. It's like, yes, I voted for them, but I so don't identify with them, I can disconnect from any of the bad stuff that they do. So I'm not responsible for what that person does. I help put them in office, but I'm not responsible for that. You can't put that back on me. So my comment to someone I heard talking that way, I said, and denial is not just a river in Egypt, but that's okay, you know. So, and you know, it's just complicated right now. We live in very complicated times, and all I can do sometimes is just shake my head and keep doing good every day, every way that I can, you know, model something much different to my three boys, you know, and say, we don't talk like that in this house, and I hope that you boys never talk like that in this house, or treat women the way that number 45 does.
Right, absolutely. Well, what I want to talk to you about next is all kinds of studies find that around the world, young people are less religious. They may be spiritual, but they're not. They may pray, they may believe in God, but they're not going to religious ceremonies. They're not going to church, temple. They're more likely to go to mosque. I think Muslim youth are probably the most religious of the religions that I've seen studies about. So what do you think is going on that young people aren't going to church or temple or mosque or whatever?
Well, I think we refer to them as spiritual but not religious. And again, there's a kind of disconnect from the traditional interpretations of what church is. And so different churches and different denominations are kind of scrambling to re-image themselves into something that will attract these people. And it's interesting, you know, there's some people who are like, oh, you need a program and you need young people and you need a rock band up front and you need all these kinds of things if you're going to be a great church. And I know at our church, we decided to ask different questions. And so the questions we started asking was, what are you passionate about that Jesus did, and how do you want to do that too? You know, so we took an inventory of what are the things we are passionate about. So,
was that for everybody or for youth that you directed that question?
It was for everyone in our church to get an idea as a whole. And some of the answers from our youth were social justice issues, also being open and affirming, a church that welcomes everyone, no matter what their gender identification is, being a church that helps the poor. And I know also for me, I became very involved in bereavement ministry, running bereavement groups and reaching out to the community with Shalom Free Clinic, offering these times for people to take a breather if they've lost a loved one and go through a grief group and, you know, find reconciliation on that journey.
So were the youth any different in their responses than the older people? Did you sort it out that way?
They wanted less ritual and more hands-on. And yet, ironically, there were some things of ritual that they absolutely would not get rid of, like certain ritual around Christmas and Easter. They're like, no, we have to keep this, you know, and we thought that's cool. But they have so much more of an openness to letting anyone come in that door and not excluding anyone. And that was a challenge to some of our folks. Some of our folks left because they simply couldn't do that. But by listening to some of the things that our youth wanted, we said, yeah, you're right. This is very important. And there were other people in our church who were advocating for that as well. We found more unity in these questions more so than division, which I thought was pretty amazing.
What was the issue mainly in terms of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered people, in terms of welcoming that kind of diversity?
There's that diversity. There's also welcoming the diversity of the homeless person. There was the diversity of welcoming other people from other faiths. We had a couple where one partner was practicing a totally different religion, and the other partner was Christian. And so how did we solve that? You know, well, we welcomed him, and he ended up just, you know, finding a place and incorporating some of our beliefs in his spiritual journey. So we just learned that opening our hearts and showing love really reaped what we were looking for way more than closing the door and saying, you can't, you shouldn't, you're evil, you're ugly, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So what kind of programs does your youth program offer to young people?
That actually is a question that the associate pastor of our church could answer much better than I. I am actually not on staff at First Christian. I am married to the senior minister. I am a chaplain who serves, but I am not on staff. And so programming and all the things that go on, you know, beyond summer camp, vacation Bible school, Sunday school, and me hauling my kids to different events, I can't tell you what the intentionality is. I wasn't prepared for that question. I'm sorry.
That's fine. In terms of your own kids, do they think of themselves as Christian, may I ask?
I would say that they identify with a Christian upbringing, but I would say that we have raised our boys to have what we call a living faith and not an inherited faith. And what I mean by that is they know how important Christianity and doing service and following the vocation that their parents have. They know how important that is to mom and dad. And when they live with us, they know the whole family participates and is involved. But we have given our kids freedom to make choices about how they want to be involved. And when they move out, you know, they have the choice to come back or to explore other avenues of spirituality. We would rather that they followed a process of taking time to find peace, connecting with their higher power, doing service, you know. And if that manifests in a Buddhist walk, so be it. If that manifests in another world religion, so be it. I'm a chaplain. I love it all. So if they weren't doing anything, that's where I would probably step up my mom card and say, you know, notice you're much calmer, much more peaceful when you actually take time out to focus on something. You know, how are you and God doing? Where are you and the divine talking? Those kinds of things. I want my kids to have a faith that they built, not that I spoon-fed them.
So what kind of family rituals, I mean, like grace, prayers before bedtime, how do you in your daily life have religious rituals?
At home, I think the celebration of the family is just basically the foundation. Our family, we are very authentic. We tend to value our opinion. And so when we're sitting around the dinner table and we're talking about world events or talking about our day, I have learned that in and of itself is really different from their peers. Their peers will say things like, my family never sits down to a meal together. You know, and sometimes we have a blessing, sometimes we don't. Sometimes we do a thing called high-low. What's the best thing that happened to you today? What's the worst thing that happened to you today? Tell me about it.
At dinner time,
yeah. I cook a meal. We play family games. We focus on being together as a unit and hearing about each other, you know. And there are times when it's, you know, fratchety. We get snotty with each other.
You're human.
Oh, yes. But there are other times when, you know, my eldest will be walking my youngest through something and say, oh, no, that's not so hard. Try this. Or my youngest may be teaching him something. You know, they listen to each other. They like each other. We are a family. And that in and of itself has been, I think, the foundation for how we model our faith. It's, you know, God is important and we are a family and we do this together. We're stronger together.
There's a book called something like Lonely Together or something by Sherry Turkle, who's a MIT professor. And she says that so many families are just kind of lonely because they're looking at their electronic screens.
Mm-hmm.
She interviewed kids who said, I wanted to throw my dad's phone in the toilet, and I hid my mom's phone because all the focus is on there. It amazes me if I go to a park and see the moms and the dads and the kids and how much adult time is spent looking at this little screen.
Mm-hmm. When we're having dinner, TV's off and no electronic devices. That's kind of an unwritten rule. You know, mom and dad are clergy, and so there are going to be times when we get that call and we have to run out to the hospital. But for the most part, and when we're playing games, when we have game, whether it be poker or Monopoly or, you know, this role-playing game thing that we do, no phones allowed. You know, it's just, this is our quality time. And so that's important. I can't say my kids are phone-free. Oh, heavens no. Oh, heavens no. but, you know, when we say it's time for FaceTime or when we say it's time for a family meeting, you know, all electronics are off. And it's usually, hey, we've got something really important. You know, like when my parents passed away, we called a family meeting and said, hey, you know, this has happened. We're going to have to go and do a funeral. We're going to have to be together with, and we expect this of you. We need this of you. And can you be supportive of that? And, or we have this saying, you know, A plus manners. When we're out, it's A plus manners. When you're home, that's when you can, you know, run around in your knickers and burp and fart and do all the things that boys do, you know. But when we're outside, it's A plus manners. And they get it. They get it. And they respond well to that.
What are their responsibilities in terms of family work? Like,
they have chores. They have chores to do around the house. We leave notes. It's like, all right, you have to clean your bathroom, hang the laundry, do the laundry, do the dishes. I'm too busy tonight. Can you guys do dinner? So there's a variety of things that they have to do, but we don't pay them for it. We just expect it to be done. We have to work as a team to get it all done. They get it.
So how do they get money for spending, like if they want to go to a movie or something?
We reward grades. So an A gets you $5, and a B gets you $3. C, nope, nothing. If they do something like over and above, we have a wood pile. So if they cut wood and stack wood, or work on a big yard project, they get extra money. But my boys go out and work. Like my middle son right now is working as a mason, helping to rebuild one of the structures out at New Clairvaux. And my oldest son works two jobs. So they get it. They really get it.
When they were younger, parents struggles with discipline. You know, what do you do if the child is... a no kind of child. No, I don't want to do that. No to this. Or resistant to doing their chores or something. How did you deal with that kind of obstinate behavior?
My boys didn't have that kind of obstinate behavior. My boys were more sneaky. How do we get this past the dragon is what they would say. It's like, how do we get to go do the thing? You know, how do we sneak out? How do we... you know, go do the thing that we know we're going to get in trouble for and then get back into the house without mom finding out. That was kind of more the stuff that I've had to deal with. I haven't really had to deal with the obstinate child so much. They're stubborn, but we can eventually reason with each other.
So if they did sneak out and you found out, what would be the consequences?
It depends on the severity of what they were doing, and that's really, you know, kind of personal, so I'm not going to go into that on the radio.
Right, but there are consequences.
Yeah, one was grounded for 3 months when we found out some behavior that was unsafe, and that was why we put that restriction on them. We said, 3-month grounding, you know, until you get your head back on right.
And he wasn't obstinate about that?
No, he pretty much conceded and was like, yep, busted. So
that's amazing. In terms of sibling rivalry, it sounds like your boys really get along. They haven't been fighting.
I would say my oldest and youngest get along best. There's 6 years between them. Mm-hmm. I would say my middle one and my oldest, they can ping off each other.
Okay, so it sounds like you've been blessed with pretty reasonable offspring.
For the most part, yes.
I did a book called 50-50 Marriage and a book called 50-50 Parenting, and what they said was the hardest times in their marriages was having kids, because you're like a servant to the kid, you don't get enough sleep, it's hard to have a romantic relationship. I wonder if that was true for you and your husband or not.
Oh, yeah. And then you throw in a child who has special medical needs and all of the doctors and financial constraints. And, you know, I had to quit my career, lock, stock, and barrel, and take care of my son. So that was a huge economic cut. So yeah, there were hardships, and there were times when, you know, I think I wanted to throttle him, and I think there were times you wanted to throttle me. You know, and I'm not going to say we have like this perfect formula. We just, some days, you know, on a sleep deprived night, just putting one foot in front of the other was really important. But for us, I think that's where our church community stepped up, and we had some adopted grandmothers who came in and really helped me take care of my youngest son. And I think without them and without our church community, I don't know how we would have gotten through those years. I know I had a friend up the street who had 10 children. And whoa. Yeah, not Catholic, not Mormon, just fertile.
Oh, my goodness.
And my boys and her children were really good friends. And so there was a lot of back and forth up and down the street, you know, and that's where we learned that, you know, you don't need these big trips to Florida and California and all the designer clothes. You know, popsicles and a sprinkler on a summer day were amazing things for these kids, and a badminton net and, you know, tater tots and green beans sometimes was our favorite summer meal with a bunch of sleeping bags on the den floor watching a Goosebump movie. I mean, we were together. That's what was important, was just being together. And we let go of the expectations of the, you know, all the worldly stuff, and we just kind of focused on our kids and on our youngest. And, you know, as his health improved and our ability to do more things, you know, came about, we just celebrated and grew and did them.
So there's ups and downs. I think a lot of times people who are newly married expect that the honeymoon lasts, and when there's a jolt, it's like, whoa, did I really make the right decision to get married?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we need to do a better job of preparing people that marriage has ups and downs, and that's just what you can expect, especially if you have kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been listening to Esther Perel on YouTube, and she wrote a book called Mating in Captivity. And it talked a lot about, you know, relationships and desire between men and women. And the minute you have children, it really zaps that, because when women's desire gets zapped when there's neediness. So if the kids are needing her all the time, then that's going to kill desire. And so if in the marriage relationship, one partner or the other partner becomes needy, that can kill desire. And so that made a lot of sense to me. I was just like, yeah, when you had, you know, three kids pulling and tugging on you, or you're nursing, and then how do you switch it up, you know, for your husband? It was just, I did not succeed at that. So it was, yeah, having children changes everything. It really does.
Right. And so we need to do a better job of preparing people so that they, because a lot of people have a baby to save a marriage. And that, it just puts strains on it. I mean, it's wonderful. I'm so glad I did it, but it's, like I said, you're being a servant to someone who tortures you by waking you up every 3 hours or whatever. And that's not romantic.
But then you get lost in their eyes, you know, when you're nursing.
Oh, yeah.
Or you stand by that crib and you're just, phew, I love this little human more so in ways that I did not know my heart could do. You know, that's the blessing, the bonding that you can have with those children. So,
oxytocin.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Lovely little chemical there.
Yeah. You're listening to Ask Dr. Gail. We're on the second Thursday of each month. Next month, Mobilize, a group that formed in Chico right after the inauguration, will be on the air talking about what they're doing in this area to make sure progression happens. And then in September, we're having two long-term married couples who have a happy marriage.
And if you have ideas for shows, would love to hear them. You can email gkimball, G-K-I-M-B-A-L-L, at csuchico.edu. So you're listening to FM 90.1, KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. So let's go back to some kind of religious concepts. If you're talking with a child who says, "What's God?" what do you say?
Well, first of all, I'm going to find out how old the child is, you know, because...
Let's say elementary school.
An elementary school child? All right, so developmentally, an elementary school child, ages 6 to 8, they're going to have... they're going to have an ability to understand concrete information, but they're also going to have magical thinking, too, at that age. And so, you know, there's still that concept of Santa Claus and Tooth Fairy going on. And so there can be a magical concept of God. So in the elementary age, I tend to keep God as, you know, God is the creator. God loves us. Some of us really love having the image of God as parent, mother, father. And some of us really love having just that concept of a loving, protecting, supporting, nurturing God. So that's what I focus on. And then if you want to learn about the nature of God, then you look at the parables in the Bible and what Jesus taught us about the relationship between he and God. So that's kind of where I focus. You know, itty bitty kids ages 2 to 5, I tend to be, you know, more God is love, God loves you, and that's it.
That's
you don't need to be anything more than that, because they're going to have a hard time getting their head wrapped around that. So as kids get older and they develop, that's when, you know, they start asking those tough questions. So let's say like you're 8 years old and a grandparent dies. You know, so that's going to rock the world of some children, and they need to understand, you know, what is life and what is death and how is death different? You know, and where do we see them again? You know, and depending on the core values of the family, you know, how are you going to communicate that to them?
So what would you say to a child about what happens after you die?
Well, this is how I handled it when my parents died, and I had to explain it to my boys. I said, and at the time they were 14, 11, and 8. And I told them, I said, you know, Grandma died last night. Mom is very sad. You're going to see Mom crying a lot because this was a very sudden and unexpected death. We are people of faith. We believe that when we die, we get to go and be with God, and God is love. And Grandpa died 4 months ago, so we believe that Grandma and Grandpa are together again in heaven. I also teach my family that death doesn't end a relationship, because as long as you have memories and you still engage with those memories, you know, Grandma and Grandpa are always with us, and we have linking objects from Grandma and Grandpa. I have, you know, Grandma's rocker and her ring, and I have Dad's ties, and these are all things that still link us to their memory. And so these are the things that I teach my children based on our core values of, you know, life eternal and life with a heavenly creator. I mean, both my parents were people of deep faith and deep service, and I have no doubt where they're at.
Have you ever, in your experience with your patients as a chaplain dying, having near-death experiences and telling you about what they saw on the other side?
I've only had a couple, and both of them were like, I was reaching for family who was there, and I took their hand, and they said, nope, not yet, you're going back. Or another one said, I followed the light, and then the light said, not yet, go back. And I've heard two of those stories. I know they're common, but in my own experiences, I've only heard two.
Yeah, it's interesting that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross
was one of the few physicians who paid attention, you know, mm-hmm. to her patients and when they told her those stories. So other doctors didn't pay attention. But she started collecting the stories, and everyone said pretty much you go through a tunnel of light, you're met by a being of light, you review your life in terms of the lessons, where you stepped up and where you didn't, you reunite with people that you love. So a lot of the people that Kubler-Ross recorded didn't want to come back because it was so blissful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard that too. And who wants to come back to a body that's dying?
Right.
You know, who wants to come back to a body that's in pain? You know, so much of hospice work is about alleviating pain and suffering and helping people to find meaning in their end time, and to, you know, help families support their loved ones during this, you know, transition. But our culture has really gotten away from the normalcy of death. We've turned death into this highly medical scenario, and everyone dies in a hospital, where it used to be two generations ago, people still died at home. You know, and kids were very familiar with death. It happened. It was a part of life. You had ritual that supported it. There was a coming together of the community and the family. There were things observed. And now, you know, we try to bypass the funeral. We don't let the kids come to the funeral. Someone dies, we tell the kids, oh, don't talk about that. Someone's going to get upset. And we're really doing them a disservice. When, absolutely. You know, children will learn the most about how to handle death and grief from their parents and the people surrounding them. And if you keep squashing their feelings and their questions, you're going to repress it. But if you answer them and allow them to ask the questions, even if they're painful, even if it hurts, even if you cry. You know, when I was very young, my grandfather, one of his brothers, Finus, passed away. And we all went to the funeral, big family funeral. And as we were at the graveside, my grandfather started to cry. And some of the aunties looked at him and said, Clyde, I don't know why you're crying. It's not going to bring him back. And my grandpa said to them, and I will never forget this, he says, I know it won't bring him back, but I feel better when I do it. And that just said something to me. You know, it really validated the need to feel your feelings. And that it's okay to cry when someone you love has died. My grandfather modeled a tremendous lesson to me. And it stayed with me all this time. And it's something I share in my bereavement groups with people who are in what we call a closed family system. They don't talk about it. And then consequently, you know, their grief goes into the body, and our issues end up in our tissues. And, you know, and then there's depression and all sorts of other stuff that can happen if a person doesn't have a healthy grief journey. So,
yeah, Carl Jung, the psychoanalyst that was a contemporary of Freud, said that what we suppress pops out in unconscious and irrational ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said the whole aim of life is to become whole, to become individuated, to become conscious of the unconscious. So to just push things down, they pop out
mm-hmm.
in ways that are harmful. So I think that's mm-hmm. a really good point, that death shouldn't be put under the carpet, because mm-hmm. it's inevitable.
Yeah.
You're going to do a grief group. Could
yes.
you talk to us about that a little bit?
Yeah, I would love to. I have a ministry that I do through Shalom Free Clinic and through my church of First Christian. And it's called Journeys of the Heart, and it is a bereavement ministry. And so what we do is we go through a 10-week course. We study this book that has 10 touchstones in it. It's called Understanding Your Grief, and it was written by Dr. Alan Wolfelt. I am going to his seminars back in Colorado. And I will, when I'm finished, I will have a death and grief certification with Colorado State University. And this has become my new passion, is helping people in journeys of grief. Grief, we tend to think it's a medical condition, and we want to throw a pill at it, and we want to tell people, here, take this pill, in 2 weeks you'll feel better, stop here are the eating. 6 steps, and once you're done, boom, you're done.
Right.
And we know now that, you know, a regular grief for anyone can go anywhere between 2 to 3 years.
Yes.
We know that it's fluid. You're going to go back and forth and back and forth between,
anger,
yes,
and all, that,
all
yeah.
of that. We know that... that our culture, because we've gotten away from listening to people who are grieving, and we don't want to hear it, and we're uncomfortable with it, that a lot of people suppress. And so consequently, a lot of these people, they'll come to my classes and they'll say, I'm going crazy. And I get to tell them, you're not going crazy, you're just grieving.
Which is natural.
Right. And it's a natural and normal process. And so we go through the book. We make the journey together. I companion them. They teach me. I'm not an expert on their grief. They teach me what their grief is like. And so the group is wonderful because they help each other. And these groups can be anywhere between 10 to 12 people. The last group I had, it was nice to sit back and listen to the wisdom that they offered to each other. Mm-hmm. We had people who had lost both parents. We had people who had lost a sibling. We had people who had lost their husband. And as they told their stories and we got to know about their loved ones and validated their feelings and validated the process that they were in, even if there was anger involved, it was just beautiful to watch. And they learned what was normal, what they could expect from themselves, how to take care of themselves, how to walk away from people who were not helping them. And, you know, we touched a little bit on what unhealthy grief responses are. You know, I really encourage people, stay away from alcohol. Yeah. That's just going to make it worse.
Yeah.
And so these were just some of the things. But the stories I hear, I love near the end when they graduate and how they've reconciled their loss and how they have hope again. That just makes my day. I love what I do. I love running these ministries. So,
is there a phone number or how can people find out about the group?
Well, my next group is going to start here. I've got two locations now. I am at the Spiritual Care Center, which is located at 295 East Washington Avenue, Chico, California. If you would like to sign up for the group, the number to call is 343-3727. The cost of the group is $65. This covers the curriculum and 10 weeks of instruction. And my other location is at Beyond Fitness and the Community Wellness Center. Feather River has a room there that they are now using for community wellness and educational classes. And when I said, hey, can I do a grief group up here? The chaplain department said, yes, we would love to.
Great.
So that group starts August 9th. And the time for both of them, we go from 6:30 to 8. I do 10 per group. Cost is $65. Call 343-3727. Two locations. You can have your pick. I do screen. I try to put my groups together and make them as homogeneous as possible. It helps when there's similar kinds of death. I know that suicide grief is different from hospice grief, which is different from SIDS grief, which is different from war grief, people who lost a loved one due to the war. So I try to cluster the people on the kind of losses, and then a more homogenous group creates a deeper bonding group. That's something I have found.
Super. Just let me remind people that you're listening to KZFR FM 90.1, and the views expressed on the show don't necessarily represent the view of the station. Ask Dr. Gale is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Theater Company, creating live theater since 2003. Chico Theater Company presents Cheaper by the Dozen August 4th through the 27th. Performances at 7:30 on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and a Sunday matinee at 2. Tickets are available at chicotix.com, at the box office, and by calling 894-3282. Share the magic of live theater at the Chico Theater Company. Ask Dr. Gale is also made possible by Design SI. Are you looking for a local company for your unique architectural and interior design needs? Design SI is a creative studio located in Chico, offering exactly what you're looking for. Designed for livable spaces and intelligence made visible. Call Design SI at 530-592-5000.
3443 or visit designssi.net for more information. And remember to tune in every second Thursday of the month from 6 to 7 to Ask Dr. Gale. Next month, the progressive group Mobilize will talk about what they're doing to make things a little bit more sane. So to wrap up, Mary, if you were talking with parents about how do you explain to your children that there's so much suffering, inequality? I'm working on a book about global youth, and one of the questions I asked in my survey of 4,000 from 88 countries was, what would you ask of the wisest person on the planet if you could talk to her or him? And a lot of people asked what happens after death, and then a lot of people asked, why is there so much inequality and suffering in the world? And if God is a loving God, why do we live on such a miserable place for so many people?
That's a huge question, and I'll be really honest. I really didn't come prepared for that. I'm sorry. I know for myself that suffering overwhelms me, and I know that power and privilege is working very hard to hang on to power and privilege. So for me, I tend to, instead of taking the big view and the big blame, this is all God's fault, I tend to narrow it down and say, what am I supposed to do today to help alleviate suffering and pain? What do I teach my children to do? What kind of behaviors do I model that shows them that we are all part of a big community? You know, how I engage with the homeless on our streets, how I help out at the Jesus Center, how I, you know, what we do as a family, how we talk about these people. You know, are we being cruel in what we say, or are we saying language that says, I don't know what happened, I know they must be hurting, so how do we help? What do we do? And also teach them how to have some healthy boundaries, because, yes, there are some people who hurt, you know. So I'm sorry I don't have a great, wonderful PhD answer for you.
I guess what I would tend to think is that we have free will, and that that God doesn't intervene in our decision-making. So we're gradually evolving from our chimpanzee and bonobo ancestors, and it's taking a lot of time to learn to be really cooperative and make good decisions. So if we have free will, so we make mistakes and errors. And then I also think that the things have gotten really skewed, that the 1%, you know, like 68 people control over half the wealth in the world and have enormous power, and they lobbyists and people with money influence who's in government and the kind of choices they make, like trying to get rid of health care for low income people and cut the tax rate for the rich. So there's power grabs that make things worse.
I think it is troubling times that we live in, and I know that to have any kind of faith right now that is living and vital is going to stand out in these dark times. And so that, I think, is what is important, is to live your faith, you know, walk humbly with your God, and to just keep being the light. Because for me, that's all I can do. I'm not a person of power. I'm a mom, and I love what I do, and I'm just going to keep on being the light.
And what I think is that for every negative, there's a positive, like Trump's outrages, like denying climate change. It really galvanized people to say, we're going to work for prevent climate change, and we're going to, the mayors and the governors and all of us are going to work together. Mm-hmm. So people are running for office who had never fought before. There's mm-hmm. those groups of people who are lobbying in congressional offices and making mm-hmm. that have been quiet before. So he's really galvanizing activism.
I have seen that greatly, and that encourages me too, because I have a couple of friends who are highly qualified and they are running for office, and they're up in Washington State, and I was like, oh, I wish I lived there. I would vote for you. So yeah, sometimes the dark brings out the light, and we get to be the light.
Yes.
And so I think that would be a great thing to end on, is, you know, resist the dark by being the light.
And what's